You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome to another edition of GNAT TV's in-depth series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director here at GNAT TV's News Project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Monday, December 9th. It's also a pleasure to be joined here in the studio by Jim Sullivan, who is the executive director of the Bennington County Regional Commission, and here to talk to us today about energy issues and maybe their relationship with climate change and a few other aspects to that. As we all know, energy issues have been kind of a major topic of discussion, not only here in Vermont, but nationwide and globally as well. And this past year, it seems like we're seeing another kind of surge of interest around all of that. Last September, many of you will remember a series of climate rallies took place, one right here in Manchester and elsewhere around Vermont, also in other major cities around the world. Shortly after that, a somewhat bleak report on climate change was released by the United Nations, and more concern about rising temperatures and our apparent difficulty with sort of curtailing the rise of temperatures that could all of a sudden, not just 30 or 40 years from now, but 10 or 15 years from now, lead to some rather bleak outcomes. Here in Vermont, the whole issue around carbon emissions seems to be returning once again as an important topic for the legislature to grapple with when they return to Montpelier in just a couple of weeks. So, Jim, your arrival here is timely, and thank you, first of all, for making the time to come in and talk with us.
Well, happy to be here. Thank you, Andrew.
Really appreciate it. So, looking at our position here in Vermont, just to kind of get us started, what do you see as sort of the primary energy challenges that we're facing as a state? We have those ambitious renewable energy goals we're trying to meet by 2050. Is that on track?
Well, as you noted, not really. But there are, I don't know, probably challenges and opportunities both on the energy front in Vermont. And the first thing that is getting the attention now certainly is issues related to climate change and greenhouse gas emissions and our desire to try to reduce those significantly over time to get to some established target levels. We've been doing better in that in some areas and in others in the area of where we get our electricity from. We're actually doing quite well. We're not doing so well in areas of space heating and transportation fuels. We can talk more about that in a little bit. But so you know, the desire to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is important. You know, there can be some argument about how effective that's going to be, because you know, climate change really is globally, and it's not like if we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions significantly in Vermont and they go up everywhere else in the world, that's not going to make much of a difference for us. But we hope that we can at least do our part, as everyone needs to, and set a good example and hopefully help drive some change nationally that way. You know, the second thing is just on the energy front itself, and an issue of that I always like to talk about is, you know, energy security. Whatever people might think about climate change, we still have the inevitability that the fossil fuels that we've relied on over the last 150 years, increasingly so, that have really contributed to all of the growth and prosperity in our society, as well as a lot of problems. Well, those are inevitably, over time, those are non-renewable resources, and they're going to become scarcer and more expensive and difficult to get. And whether it's 10, 20, or 50 years from now, our reliance on those is going to be have to fall off. They're just going to get a lot more expensive and difficult to procure. So what in the world are we going to do when pretty much our entire society and economy relies on those things? So, you know, trying to figure out a way to make to use less energy and to transition to different fuel types is really critical. And the third thing, and one I think everybody can really agree on, is an opportunity, an economic opportunity. Because right now, even Bennington County alone, we're exporting literally tens of millions of dollars every year out of the region's economy to purchase these fuels that are imported into our region. And if we can reduce the amount that we spend on those fuel sources, we'll have that much more money to spend inside our own economy, in our own communities. And a lot of that money can actually be spent developing those new renewable energy technologies and energy efficiency measures that help us meet our goals. So it's it's really a win-win and a great economic opportunity for us.
Well, as you mentioned, fossil fuels, gasoline, oil, propane have been so central and integral to how we get around, the operations of the economy. Replacing all that, or 90% of that, which I guess is what we'd like to try and do by 2050, that's a pretty tall order. And isn't that going to be fairly expensive and fairly disruptive?
It's a fairly tall order, but I think that it's something that's doable, and it's something that we really have to do. Is it going to be expensive? Well, it's going to be expensive, but continuing to rely on fossil fuels is pretty expensive too. I think we've seen the cost of renewable alternatives come down considerably, and maybe if you look at it at a more personal level, you can see how the opportunities are really there. While there's some cost, there's significant benefit. So, if you look at just an individual's house, say for example. Will it cost money to weatherize the house? It'll cost probably a few thousand dollars, although there's some very good incentives for that right now. Will it cost to change over to an alternative heating system, like a high-efficiency air source heat pump or a wood-burning furnace or boiler or a pellet stove? Yeah, that'll cost money too. But if you look at the other side of it, you'll be saving more money than you're going to be spending in the long run, and quite a bit, actually. So, play that out over the economy as a whole, and it costs a lot of money to invest in energy efficiency and renewable energy and alternative energy sources, but you save as much or more while doing some real positive things for the environment.
So the hard part has always seemed to me to be to get over that hurdle, that initial hurdle, the upfront costs that folks will have to deal with, whether it's weatherizing a home or another thing, which I know is kind of, central to the long-term plan to kind of reduce the amount of fossil fuels we burn in the transportation sector, and that's increasing the sales of electric cars. I mean, that seems to be seen as like one important ingredient in how we're eventually going to wind up spending less on fossil fuels. How is that going? Because electric cars seem to be a very attractive proposition. The maintenance costs, once you own one, the maintenance costs seem to be much less than a traditional gas-powered car. And yet, we're still seeing, I think, fairly small numbers of them on the roads. How do we get from here to there?
Yes, that's something that folks have been trying to figure out, because you're absolutely right. That is a really critical component of the energy goals that the state has. And the rate of uptake on electric cars has been pretty low relative to where we'd like to see it. That upfront cost, you're right, has been an impediment, and it is for a lot of newer technologies. If you remember the days when the first energy efficient light bulbs came out, and people were like, "Well, I'll pay $12 for a light bulb."
Right.
And now
I do remember that.
Yeah, now the energy efficient light bulbs are less expensive than a lot of times the incandescent bulbs, and they cost a lot less to operate. So the challenge is to provide the programs and incentives that are needed to get to increase the demand so that the supply is provided. And as the supply comes up, as more manufacturing happens, then economies of scale start to kick in and it gets cheaper. And we're certainly starting to see that in the electric vehicle or EV world. It's perhaps not happening quite as quickly as some would like. And I think it's partly because there's some misconceptions out there about electric cars, too. As far as the upfront costs, I mean, there's great incentives now. My wife and I bought an electric car, our second one, this past summer. And it was... there was a $7,500 federal tax credit that comes right off the price of the car. There was a $5,000 incentive from the manufacturer working with Green Mountain Power. There was another $1,500 incentive from Green Mountain Power through a state program. And then there was another just random dealership incentive for $1,000. So I think all in told, I believe we had at least $15,000 to $16,000 off the price of the car. It took the car from being close to $30,000 to about $15,000 for a really nice brand new car. That's not too expensive. If you're going to buy a new car, you know, that's not too bad. Now, there's also a growing market for used EVs, you know, and there's also incentives for those. So there's still, you know, The battery price is still higher than we'd like it to be, and as I said, over time, the cost per kilowatt hour of battery capacity comes down, and the vehicles will be even more affordable. The other big concern that people always have with EVs is range. What is this thing of range anxiety? I can't drive an electric car because I can't go anywhere and everywhere I want to go. And it's true right now that if my car has a range of maybe 175 miles in the summer and a bit less in the winter. And so, yeah, I'm not going to be able to drive everywhere I want to all the time. But, you know, 99% of the time, I can go everywhere I want to in a day. I mean, if people drove 150 miles or more every day, they'd be putting 50,000 miles on their cars. And they're just, people by and large don't do that. You know, we use our cars to get around the town and the region. I drove my car up here today. I'll be driving it down to Stamford tonight. Not a problem. So, you know, by and large, you can get by. And so what my wife and I do, we have one electric car and we have one plug-in hybrid. So we're basically both driving electric cars, but the plug-in hybrid can switch over to gas. So if we are planning a longer trip, we'll take that one. So it works out very well. It's a good solution. And, you know, recognize a new car is not in the cards for everybody. Even with discounts, it can still be expensive. So, you know, we're hoping that over time, you know, the price continues to come down. And as you mentioned, the operating cost is just a lot less. You know, it costs the equivalent of about $1.50 per gallon of gas to drive an electric car right now. And as you know, there's no oil changes. The mechanical systems are so much simpler. Very few things go wrong. So it's a great option, and I'm very enthusiastic about EVs.
Well, one of the other areas you folks at the BCRC have been seeming to focus a lot of attention on lately is weatherization. You know, like what you also just mentioned there. Working with Efficiency Vermont to try and encourage more folks to insulate their homes better or take some steps to reduce their energy consumption and a win-win thing, heat their homes better, you know, particularly with winter coming on. That's a big deal for a lot of us, me included, who I just had an energy audit come to over at my place. It's quite interesting to do the walkthrough. I guess, what's your sense on how that's going? We've been hearing about weatherization for a while now. It seems like a logical, obvious step for the most folks, particularly in a state like Vermont. We have a lot of older housing stock built, you know, 50, 80, 100 years ago, in some cases much longer than that. Are the incentives in place for that, do you think, sufficient to encourage enough people to make that step?
There are some really good incentives now. And you're right. I mean, transportation and heating buildings, those are the two places that we really need to focus our energies. And so that's what we've been really trying to push at the Regional Commission and in conjunction with our local energy committees. We have an older housing stock, a lot of drafty old buildings that, you put a little bit of energy in and it goes, right out and out through the attic and the gaps in the walls. And it's really frustrating because, that little bit of energy in a properly weatherized house can stay and heat the house and keep it warm for a long period of time and keep it much more comfortable. I think that one of the real challenges with the weatherization move is that it can seem to be a little bit complicated because there's a lot of steps, as you mentioned. So you may have had a home energy walkthrough or a home energy audit. So then you'll get a report back that'll tell you, here are 10 things you can do to improve the energy performance of your house. And then you'll need to say, okay, now I've got to get a contractor, I've got to figure out how to pay for it. So there's a financing piece that comes into it. And then to get any incentives, I've got to get the inspections done. And people say,
too much work.
Too much. So there's really an effort out there to try to make it simpler. And organizations like NeighborWorks of Western Vermont have been really involved in trying to kind of help people walk right through the process from beginning to end, to go from getting the home energy audit done, to seeing what the options are, and then pointing them very clearly to the incentives that are available. Like Efficiency Vermont now has an incentive for the next year of, 50% of the cost of weatherization up to $4,000 for most folks, or $20,000 if you're higher income, but really significant incentive payments to bring the price down. And then there's financing options that are available too, that for a lot of people, you can finance the balance at a rate of anywhere from 0% to 4% interest, and you find that the savings in the amount of fuel that you're burning is significantly more than the cost of the improvement on a monthly basis. But I recognize that it's a bit intimidating, and that's why I always encourage people, talk to somebody who knows the process and can simplify it for you, And in our area, NeighborWorks of Western Vermont is available, and for income-eligible households, the Bennington-Rutland Opportunity Council has the State Weatherization Assistance Program, and they'll do work for free. So that really helps reduce the obstacle.
That sounds good.
So, yeah.
It also seems that a number of communities are starting or forming local energy committees. I mean, mm-hmm. one in Dorset, I guess, is probably the prime example. They seem to have really gotten ahead of the curve and are doing some interesting work with the Vermont Council on Rural Development right now. But other towns seem to be kind of getting into that act as well. Will those committees help sort of regular, ordinary residents kind of get through that the complexity of weatherization?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the local energy committees are going to be absolutely critical to this, to the effectiveness of the programs that are out there, because that local contact and that locally based information is really critical. Three or four years ago, we developed a really comprehensive regional energy plan that had a lot of specific strategies about weatherization and transportation and renewable energy. And then we worked with most of the towns in our region at this point to develop local energy plans that kind of bring that down to the local level and say, these are the kinds of things that need to be done in our community to help us reach our goals and to hit our targets. That's great. We know what we need to do. We know how many houses we need to weatherize. We know, how many, how much of the improvement to our transportation system needs to happen. We know all these things. We know numbers. But now who's going to do it? And we really didn't have other than the Dorset Energy Committee that's been around for quite a while and a few lone advocates here and there, really didn't have that kind of organization. So almost a year ago, we put out a real push to try to get communities to form energy committees to work with their towns to take those town energy plans that have been developed and take some ownership of them and kind of take the lead in implementing some of those programs. And so thankfully a lot of towns have really stepped up. So we see new energy committees in, you know, Pownal and Bennington and Sunderland and Arlington and Manchester, and so it's been really good to see. And you know, there a lot of them are just getting up and going now, but I think there's a lot of enthusiasm, there's a lot of great people involved, and I think it's going to make a big difference.
One of the things that, well, this probably wouldn't apply so much in the case of Bennington, which has had a couple of controversies in this area, but I was thinking back before we went on the air that, you know, if we were having this conversation 10 or 12 years ago, we probably would have been talking a lot about wind and solar power. Mm-hmm. Now, I know down in Bennington there was a very controversial, actually I think two controversial solar projects that were in the works, but when it comes to things like wind energy, which at one point I think was considered to be kind of an important ingredient in how we were going mm-hmm. to get to a good place in terms of renewable energy, are there any wind projects happening anywhere in the state at this point?
I don't think there are any large-scale ones happening right now in the state. There are some smaller installations happening. We actually have a wind turbine manufacturer in Bennington County, and Star Wind Turbines out in East Dorset. And mm-hmm. My understanding is that they are quite busy and have a lot of projects going out. They're kind of the mid-scale, commercial-sized turbines, as opposed to the really large installations you might like, the ones you see up on the mountain in Searsburg and down on the Hoosac Range in Massachusetts. But to answer your question, the other leg of our energy puzzle or stool is renewable energy development, because a lot of our transition really relies on electrification. So, electric vehicles and high efficiency electric heating systems, so we recognize that. That we're probably going to use a lot more electricity over time, notwithstanding our efforts to be more efficient. We're still going to, through 2050, we'll probably be using 50% more electricity than we're using now. And that's electricity has to come from somewhere. The question is, how much of it should we be generating locally in our area? And you make a lot of assumptions about that, but a significant amount would be a good thing in a distributed energy system, because you control that and you have access to that, rather than relying on hoped for renewable energy imports from places like Hydro-Quebec or offshore wind projects or something like that. So in our regional energy plan, we do call for like 85 megawatts of new solar energy capacity, and wind really is a significant component. It should be probably another 25 megawatts of wind energy capacity in our region over the next 30 plus years. How do we get there? Well, there's been quite a bit of solar energy development happening. Rooftop and backyard solar of different scale has been significant, and there have been some larger installations, controversial and not. The wind, there has not been a lot of progress on wind energy development recently since the Deerfield Wind Project, the second phase of that in Searsburg. I think, over time, that the importance of wind to balance out the energy load over time is really going to become compelling. Solar is great. I have solar panels on my house for both electricity and hot water, but I will tell you, on days like this, there's not a lot going on. And so-called storage will only do so much. It's not like in the summer we're not going to store all the electricity that we need to use in the winter. And on days like this in the winter, you're not going to store enough electricity to even use overnight. So, you know, balancing it out with another energy, so renewable energy source like wind is really important and a good thing. And I appreciate the fact that not everybody likes to look at solar panels or wind turbines, and they shouldn't be everywhere, and we should avoid them in environmentally sensitive and aesthetically sensitive areas. But if we want to get to where we say we want to get to, we're going to have to accept that we need some of them.
Well, as someone who deals in land use planning an awful lot, I guess I'm wondering, are you seeing any headway or progress finally being made around the idea of setting aside certain parcels of land within given communities that most folks would say, okay, over here, where there used to be a landfill, let's say, is a good place to have a solar development. It can be screened off so the neighbors don't have to look at it, and we can get away from the not-in-my-backyard mentality. Are we finally beginning to make some progress in that direction where we're going to be able to come up with some sensible rules around land, you know, where to site them so that people who live next to them don't kind of have a hard time?
I think we are, and I think that we have, and I think we should have been thinking that way many years ago. but you know, the state has identified kind of these statutorily defined preferred sites. They call them preferred sites. Things like old landfills, abandoned gravel pits, developed surfaces like rooftops and parking lots and brownfield sites, and those get a an automatic incentive for anyone who builds on them. So developers certainly go right there. They look for those places first and foremost, and that's good. Now, on top of that, in all the towns that we've been working with, we've been strongly encouraging them to do some real hard thinking and planning, bring out all the maps, involve property owners and neighbors and everybody else, and try to identify enough land in their community to support a reasonable amount of solar development. And once that land is identified, to, you know, put it right on the map in the town plan that said, this is our town preferred site for solar. We've talked about the different places. We've determined that the negative impacts associated with developing on this site are something that we can accept, given the benefit to our community, and so put on a map. And several towns in our region have done that already. And so those operate just like, you know, building on those statutory sites. Mm. So the developers get the same incentive for locating on those town-identified sites. So we're probably in our region, in Bennington County, we're pushing that idea more than anywhere else in the state. But I think it has real good prospects for success.
We have time for about one more question here, and I guess I can't let you leave without giving you a chance to talk a little bit about your wood heating and biomass event you're having Union Underground Restaurant in Manchester, on Wednesday, the 10th. 11th?
Actually, it's this week? The 10th.
The 10th.
Tuesday the 10th.
Tomorrow.
So, right away, yeah.
Right.
So, well, thanks for that. Yeah,
no. Because I think that that's another important part of the whole puzzle as well.
It is. I mean, if you look out almost any window, you will see a lot of energy resource all over the hills and mountainsides here, and that's, you know, those woody biomass resources contain a lot of energy, and properly managed can produce sustainable harvest and again support the local economy while providing plenty of heat for hundreds or thousands of additional buildings in our region. So there's also some good incentives out there now for purchasing new wood-based heating systems for residential and commercial scale. But the meeting we're doing at Union Underground tomorrow at 5:30 is focused on the residential sector specifically, and looking at the opportunities for cordwood and wood pellet based systems in the home specifically. So we'll have somebody from the wood heating specialist from the Vermont Department of Forest, Parks and Recreation will be down to talk about their programs. And the reason we're having it at Union Underground, other than the fact that it's a really great place to have a meeting, and they have a pretty good tap list, I think, is that that entire building is actually heated with a pellet system.
Oh, really?
So we'll have an opportunity to take a look at that as well.
And probably have a bit of a dinner afterwards.
There's free refreshments, and as I said, it's a great place for a meeting.
All right. Well, there's so much more we could talk about on this fascinating subject. And one of them, I always find myself wondering about, is like, what happens if none of this gets done? You know, I mean, if none of these initiatives ever gain traction to the point where they need to, I guess...
That could be like an entire really depressing show.
Right. We could talk about that for half an hour. Probably get really, really bummed out, I'm sure. Yeah. But anyway, we'll save that for another time. Maybe sometime next time you're back.
Great.
We'll talk about that one. All right. Well, Jim, thanks so much for being with us today. Really
Thank
appreciate
you,
your time and input on this really important subject. And thanks to you as well for being with us today also. Hope you've enjoyed the show and found it informative, and we'll see you again the next time. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.